Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Oh, what happened to my other introduction? I don't know, so I will just get started. Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life, because that's what it's all about, right? How amazing to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you want to join me today, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. I would love to hear what's on your mind, what's weighing on you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, overeating, compulsive eating, any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. The real problem is what's eating at you. Okay, so here is a question from Jeanette. She says, I feel guilty whenever I eat something that isn't 100% clean. Then I obsess about it, and I get so upset I end up eating more. How do I stop feeling so guilty in the first place so I won't end up eating more? Great question, Jeanette. Just first, just a little comment on this 100% clean eating. What the heck? What is the opposite of clean eating? What is it, dirty eating? When did eating become clean? Really, when did eating become clean? And then if you're not eating 100% clean, which, by the way, what is that? What does that mean? That means something different to everybody. When you're not eating 100% clean, then you feel guilty. So, you know, that's the, oh my gosh, I wasn't going to eat sugar, but I ate a cookie. So therefore, the day is ruined, absolutely ruined, and now I must eat the whole rest of the cookies. That's how that goes. So, Jeanette, you want to know how to stop feeling so guilty about what you're eating. And I think it's important to explain the difference between guilt and shame as a way of helping you feel less guilty. So what's the difference between guilt and shame? So guilt is about something you did or did not do. So guilt references behaviors, actions. People feel guilty when they think they've done something wrong or when they choose not to take an action. So guilt sounds like, I've done something really bad and wrong. I ate a cupcake. And I don't mean to mock. I'm not mocking. This is how it often sounds like, because we often police our food choices. We've criminalized eating, right? You're either good or you're bad. People say all the time, oh, I was so good. I ate 100% clean. I was so good. Or I was so bad. Bad. I ate pizza. I ate carbs. I ate sugar. I was bad. So when you distill it down to this right and wrong, good or bad, it's easy to feel guilty and bad about something that you ate instead of, okay, like where's the moral judgment, really? You ate pizza or you ate iceberg lettuce. One does not make you better than the other. Guilt is, I've done something really bad and wrong. I ate something I think that I shouldn't have eaten. Shame, of course, is much worse. Shame is about who you are as a person. It is about your essential character. So with shame, it's not that you've done a bad thing. It's not that, oh, I did something I shouldn't have done. I ate the cupcake. It's that there's something essentially bad about you because you ate the cupcake. So shame is, shame sounds like there's something really wrong with me because I did that bad thing. There's something really bad about me because I, and you know, people take it to different places. I have no willpower. I have no self-control. There's something wrong with me. What's wrong with me? And the first step is to actually move shame to guilt. So I think, Jeanette, when you're saying you feel guilty, you obsess about not eating 100% clean, you know, I'm wondering if this isn't more about shame than about guilt. You feel bad about yourself, and that makes you want to eat more. Why? Not logical, psychological. It makes you want to eat more because you want to escape yourself or you want to comfort yourself. often we turn to food to get away from our own mean voices, the voices in our head, the voices that are saying, you suck. How could you have eaten that? You have no willpower. You're horrible. You're not like other people. Rawr, rawr, rawr. Mean, mean. Oh, here's a caller. Hold that thought. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina. Hello?
Dinner with Ryan.
Hi, caller. I hear the radio on in the background. Can you mute me, or as I hear myself, and I don't hear you.
Hi, caller. You're on
with Dr. Nina.
Hello.
Hi, caller. Welcome. Can you turn the show off so I can talk to you? Because there's a delay, and I can hear you.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Better?
That's better. So, hi, what's your name?
My name is Nick.
Nick?
I can't get you on my phone. I had to use...
I didn't recognize your voice. I didn't recognize the number, and I didn't recognize your voice because I couldn't hear you because I was hearing myself. Welcome back, Nick.
It's been a rough 10 days or so. I talk about food and stuff, but I had to call you. I didn't go before because I felt badly. I got a call. My cousin, who I'm very, very close to, is very, 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 very ill.
I'm so sorry.
And I'm having a lot of trouble with it. Last Saturday, I had plane reservations to leave in the morning. And before I left, his wife called me and said, you know, don't come. He doesn't want to see anybody. We don't know what's going on. And I didn't go. And I felt so terrible that I didn't go, even though he didn't want to see me. He doesn't want to see anybody. And I've been waiting for the phone to ring for me to pick up and go. And I talked to his wife, and I said to his wife, and I thought was comfortable, but maybe it was the wrong thing to say, is, God, what are we going to do without him? Because he's such a big part of my life, and obviously a big part of her life. And I thought, maybe I said the wrong thing. But it was something I wanted to say, like, you know, some kind of support, like, what am I going to do without him? And she said, you know, I haven't tried thinking about that a lot, but I know I'll cry a lot.
You spoke a truth that no one wants to think about, but you're not whitewashing it. You're not sugarcoating it. Pardon the expression. You're speaking what's probably in her heart as well. Not that I know, but when a loved one, whether it's a spouse or a cousin, is in that dire of a strait, of course your mind goes there. It's not like she said, I might lose him. I think she knows. They'd all know what the situation is. So do you feel guilty for having said that? Is that where you are?
Yeah, yeah, I really do. And, you know, and so I talked to him once. The time I talked to him was last Friday, and that's when I realized what kind of shape he's in. And I said, okay, I'm going to come there. He says, don't. I said, I'm going to call you tomorrow morning, which was from the airport. I was at the airport to go. And he didn't answer the phone. And that scares me. Being so far away, he's in Atlanta.
But you're respecting his wishes. You're respecting his wishes. And to go might make you feel better, but it might not be what he wants. So for you to respect his wishes is really something I hope you can feel good about. You're honoring what he wants. It may not be what you want, but it is what he wants. As for what you said to his wife, look, if he, I think you've mentioned him before. This is the person who had lung cancer, something like that.
This is what I've been talking to you about for months and months.
So if he has lung cancer and she's there day to day, she knows exactly, and he's not doing well, she knows what's going on. She may say she hasn't let herself think about it, but you saying it, it's not like she said, oh my gosh, I never gave that a thought. Like, this is the first time I've considered that he might not make it. You're just saying what she already knows, and there's actually some relief in that. You know, when people who have had terrible illnesses have told me that what makes them most aggravated is when everyone pretends everything is better than it is. Oh, you're going to get through this. It's going to be good. You're going to learn a lesson. But when people say, wow, this sucks, I'm sorry you're going through this, this is horrible, they actually feel more understood and better and not dismissed. So if anything, what you said was a gift to her, that she's not alone in thinking this, and that you're someone that she can turn to about her fears.
I hope so. I think so, and I hope so. It's just a very upsetting thing, and my best friend, and I forever and ever and ever, and just the thought of it's just like, you know, I don't want to go there and look at him the way he probably looks, and remember him like that. Instead of remembering of all the good times and laughs we had together.
Yes.
I mean, even on the phone when he's sick, we would always laugh and always do that. And that's what I've been kind of crazy the last 10 days where I've been. I mean, in a zone that I don't know what to do. You know,
there's nothing
different
you can do to make some things different. How have you been comforting yourself during this time? What have you been doing to feel better? Has ice cream been involved?
I'm not involved in anything like I was talking before when I saw you. Nothing. I have nothing.
I'm not eating.
I'm not eating ice cream.
You sound depressed. Yeah.
I haven't had anything.
Okay, you're in a grieving mourning. It's good that you're not turning to food, though it doesn't sound, it sounds like you're turning away from food because you're depressed and sad. But, you know, it's very important at this time for you to comfort yourself with words, to be able to acknowledge. Remember my VARE acronym, validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself, to validate that this is a horrible situation to be going through. It's scary, it's sad, it's awful. And to acknowledge that, of course, you feel this way, but don't go to beating yourself up for something you said or didn't say, or you got on the plane or you didn't get on the plane. You're respecting his wishes. You want to be there. A part of you doesn't want to be there, and that's understandable. Acknowledge that and validate that. A part of you, I'm sure, doesn't want to see him like this. You don't want to confront the reality, even though a part of you wants to see him. So you're in conflict. And to acknowledge that this is tough, and right now you need all the support that you can get.
I love you. Thank you.
I'm so sorry you're going through this. I am so sorry. Yeah. It's a truly awful and helpless feeling when a friend or someone we love is facing an illness, possibly a terminal illness. It brings up so many different questions and thoughts about our own mortality, about our own powerlessness, about so much. And that's when we need to be the most there for ourselves, too. That's not selfish. That's self-care. and reassuring yourself, acknowledging the reality, the truth. The truth is something no one wants to look at, but it must be faced, because, and you can bear it. Don't turn it against yourself. Don't turn against yourself and start picking yourself apart. I shoulda, coulda, woulda. That doesn't help. For you or anyone else out there who's listening and going through a hard time, turning against yourself just makes things worse. You've been a good friend. You have a meaningful, important friendship that will stay with you no matter what happens. He's part of you. He's in your heart. He's there, as much as it hurts to lose somebody potentially. And it sucks. It's horrible. It's awful. And that's the thing no one wants to say. It's fucking awful. Oh, did I just say that? I did. Yikes. Luckily, we're on internet radio. I just said it. Okay. But I sometimes you just got to say it. That's the only word that it's the word that fits. It's just effing awful. It just is. So
it is.
Oh, it's the worst. It's awful. And only by recognizing that and feeling it and expressing it and talking about it with other people like you are with me right now, can you bear it. When you try to distract yourself from the awfulness by turning against you, all that happens is you feel bad, and then you end up, then you end up, I don't know, eating ice cream or chips and then getting mad at yourself for that. We don't want that to happen. We want to just acknowledge.
No, we don't. We don't.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Thank you so much. So much. I can't tell you. Thank you so much.
Well, Nick, please keep me posted, and please be kind to yourself. You need
I that. Will.
Okay. Take good I care. Will.
Thank you, dear.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh. Oh, that just breaks my heart. That's just so hard. So hard. So Nick was feeling guilty. So Nick, if you've got your volume back up, here's how to get rid of that guilt, besides recognizing what's the truth, what is really going on. You got to think about what's making you feel guilty and consider what your quote-unquote crime is. So often people say, I have another call. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Nina. This is Anne.
And hello.
Hi. My question is, how do I move closer and really become open to more clearly and better understanding the connection between how I perceive myself, my body, I guess, and how I use eating as a way to
distract?
I don't know if it's
punish?
A distractor. I guess, well, that's what I'm part of the question is, how do I come closer to understanding why I am using, and this is a simplistic way of asking it, why I'm using food the way I am, why these issues are so prevalent still?
Well, it's not simplistic. It's a very good question. It will have not a simple answer, of course. The answer is always complicated, and it has to do with your specific history, temperament, background. I detected two things as we were talking. One is when you said my body, you almost hesitated as if it was hard for you to say my body, like hard to own your body. And the second thing I noticed is you said after all this time. So there, I want to tell you that after all this time, time does not heal all. time. I have people in my private practice who are in their 70s, and you know, it's not like they became older and suddenly magically these issues disappeared, because they're not related to age. They're related to your relationship to yourself, which is what you really addressed in the beginning. There's something about your relationship to yourself that's getting in the way of being nurturing in all ways, with food. And I'm guessing, what about with other ways? Are you nurturing yourself with a kind attitude towards yourself, or are you disparaging of yourself?
I think there's some variability with that, but I would say within the last 8 or so years, I've been moving in the direction of trying to be more compassionate. And I'm not looking for a formula that's a one fits all. I just want to know how I
there is no
can
formula. There is no one size
go in fit. A direction.
Yeah. So let me ask
no,
you a
I know,
few questions.
But I,
sorry. Okay. Go on.
No, I'm listening to your question.
Oh, I think there was a slight delay and I was talking over you, so I apologize for that. First of all, there is no one-size-fits-all formula, because then someone would just create a checklist, maybe me, and it would be like, okay, do this, 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 and this, and done. There you go. If only there was such a formula. So I guess my question is, when did this relationship to your body, and when I said what I said about noticing a hesitation before you said my body, did that resonate with you? Is it hard?
Yes, there's a definite disconnect and an absolute discomfort with even acknowledging my body.
Yeah, there's that pause again. So when did this start? When did this relationship to yourself or your body self and food and all of this, when did it begin?
Probably adolescence.
How old were you?
I was 13 or 14.
And what do you remember about your relationship to yourself at that time and how food became part of the picture?
I have very sparse, scant memories, but what I can recall in a very general way is that certainly food was plentiful and available, and that I certainly started eating in secret.
And what was the attitude in your family towards, of course, adolescence, and 13, 14 is when your body starts changing. You go from being adolescence is that in between, as you know, going from being a child to having a more womanly body. What were the messages about that in your family growing up or in school or just surrounding you at that time?
In the environment I was in that home, there wasn't any privacy for starters. And I would say oftentimes the body, in particular parts of the body, were referred to in crass and uncomplimentary ways.
Specifically female bodies, and who was making these references? Who was being
crass?
You
know, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Parents? Dad?
They were just there.
You don't want to say?
Right.
Okay. Okay, so would you say there was someone in the family who was making you feel objectified in the worst possible way?
I don't think there was anything deliberate like that. I think it was
across
the family system.
Yeah,
I think it was across the family system, and it wasn't specifically directed toward Anne. necessarily.
Oh, and it doesn't have to be.
I mean, it became that way.
Yeah.
I was always the plumper, fatter twin.
Twin.
And that was an early identity.
Identical twins?
Yes.
Ah.
Well, at first when we were born in early childhood, I was smaller. I started smaller. But then that changed.
Okay, so there's some things going on here. Often with twins, there's a splitting, especially identical twins, but it doesn't have to be, where there becomes the good twin and the bad twin, the fat twin and the thin twin. But it's some form of good or bad. And
I was the good, though.
Mm-hmm. You were the good.
I tried to be.
Yeah. You were the good twin, and your sister was not the good twin. So there's this splitting, and then if you're the good twin, there's a lot of pressure to be very good. How did that...
I know, but I never succeeded, really, honestly.
Well, how would you know if you succeeded?
Because I would know. I would have evidence. I would definitely know.
What evidence?
I would know. I just would have measurable evidence, and I know this is taking up a lot of time.
No, it's fine. I like to talk to people for a little bit of time. How else can I can't just say, oh, let me speak with you for 3 minutes and tell you. So I want to get some background. And you know what? People listening, as I'm talking to you, it makes them think about their own situation. So this is actually
okay.
Helpful.
I wanted to be aware of other people.
Yeah. No, this is good. You're helping other people by talking with me. So first of all, you have an amorphous, nebulous kind of messaging in the family, which is that female bodies are viewed as objects, as things. And I imagine, you know, why don't you tell me what that was like for you? What did it mean to be an object seen as described in crass ways, which I imagine there's some sexuality involved in that, whether blatant or like an undercurrent of it, because...
Okay, thank you. I don't think I have recollections about what it was actually like, or maybe I'm just feeling so alienated from...
So, Anne, what I
said... That aspect of me.
Yeah. So what I'm going to suggest is there's something called lived memory. So I hear this a lot of times where my patients will be like, I don't remember my childhood. I don't remember my past. I just have these thoughts. So I just for some reason, like, hate my body. I just have these mean thoughts about myself. That's just how it is. So they don't consciously remember where these thoughts come from, but they internalize the thoughts, and now... They are replaying their histories. They're replaying the memories, only now they're saying it to themselves instead of hearing it from others. So even if you don't remember...
Yes, and that fits to some extent where maybe it's a little different, is sometimes the memory that I have is experienced in my body. So for example, if fear sweeps over me, it's not that I'm engaging in particular thoughts. It's that I'm experiencing sensations in my body that speak of fear to me.
And as an analyst, as a psychoanalyst, I would say you may be having unconscious thoughts. Your mind is keeping it out of awareness, but your body is keeping it in operation. So all you experience is the sensation of the fear, but you experience the sensation of fear, but you don't know what the thoughts are. They're hidden in your unconscious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is fear often the what you experience?
Yes. Or terror.
Terror is fear on steroids.
Uh-huh.
And I know without...
It is.
You know, without saying too much, I know you're, you know, it's hard to reveal a lot on a radio show. What do you associate with that terror?
Mostly, I think a person, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or a particular room. But then I second guess and doubt myself and think, no, why would that be? There's no rational explanation for that kind of experience.
Feelings aren't rational. And as I am fond of saying, this is not logical. This is psychological. So if you're having a sudden...
I like logical.
Yes, it's so much more comfortable. It's black and white, except it has no room in our interior worlds are not run by logic. It's psychological. So if there's something that is creating an experience of terror in your body, it means that something is being reactivated. It may not be in your actual, it may be something that you don't understand, but something is creating that feeling that, so you keep it hidden because why do we have an unconscious? Because it's too unbearable. That's why dreams are the window into our unconscious minds. They're the in-between between what we consciously know and what we don't want to know, but yet a part of us wants to know, if that makes sense.
So, it does. I just am not sure that it's true for me. I'm not sure about that. It could be some arbitrary thing that happens to me. I really don't know.
It could be some arbitrary thing that happens to you, but if it's taking you to terror, it means it's that arbitrary thing that happens to you plus the meaning of that arbitrary thing that's happening to you, which might take you to re-experiencing the past. So I guess I know you asked a very specific question, and how I wish I had that checklist for you to give you a very specific answer. But if you keep calling the show, I don't know if you've been listening to Nicole, like she's been calling over and over and over, and we just now in talking are making some breakthroughs that I don't think she would have ever made if she had just called once, which is my invitation for you to call back. So, but what I'm hearing already is that there are wounds from the past that are unhealed.
It doesn't make sense, but yeah, maybe.
Well, it makes sense if you look at it not from a logical, rational, intellectual perspective, but from the perspective of this. Here's some logic for you. I'll give you an example, not using you. Because I don't know you enough to make a... all I have are questions right now to try to come up with some thoughts about what might be happening. But I do know everyone has an unconscious, and everyone, when they're unconscious, are just sort of not made conscious, they are triggered and triggered and triggered and triggered. But once you make that unconscious conscious and deal with it, then you heal, and then this stops. So here's my example. And it's a very simple example, but often I hear women especially come in and they say, I don't like nice guys. I like bad boys. And these are women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, like women of all ages. And they come into me and they're like, yeah, I want to have a relationship, but I don't like those nice guys. I just am a sucker for those bad boys. I like them. Bad boys can be 60. They still love them. And so inevitably, we look back in their past, and they say, it's not about the past. Why is everything about the past? And I tell them, it's not about the past. Our whole job is to put the past in the past. We want to see how the past is haunting your present. How is the past being relived in your present? So tell me about these bad boys. And when they start talking about these guys, they'll remind them of someone in their family, or either an immediate family, a parent, a sibling, or an aunt, or a grandparent, or someone who was close to them. Inevitably, there's something about these rejecting bad boys that feels familiar. And that familiar feeling from a relationship in the past, that's the unhealed wound from the past that they're trying to heal in the present. So the mind's logic goes, I had this rejecting person in my family, let's just say family, and that person is still rejecting, but and I don't care about that person. I'm over that person. But, ooh, that rejecting guy, I don't know why, but I really like him. And it, by the way, for men, it's rejecting women. And so they're trying to heal the rejecting relationship from the past with this new relationship with a similarly rejecting person, hoping that if they can get this rejecting bad boy to like them, it'll somehow heal the past wound. Although they don't think of that consciously. When we heal the original wound with the original rejecter, in the case of my example, you know what happens? They stop liking the bad boys, they stop being mean to themselves, and they start looking for guys who are nice. Instead of trying to convert a bad boy into a nice, loving, generous person, they go for people who are already nice, loving, and generous. Make sense?
Oh, yes, I understand the logic and the connection.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
Yeah. So it's really hard to recognize when we look back and we think about times when we were young and vulnerable, and we don't like to think about that. It's painful. It's difficult. It brings us back to a
time. Actually, it's not. It's not painful or difficult. It's blank. I don't really have any feelings associated with much of anything
yeah.
in my internal landscape.
And because it's being all relived now. Yeah.
I don't know, but mostly I don't feel.
Yeah, because when you don't feel, but you are feeling terror, when you don't feel, that is protection.
Only fleeting.
Yeah, it's only protection. Fleetingly. There's something, you have built up protection against feeling things you don't want to feel. Would be my guess.
I'm master at that, probably.
Yeah, so we have to make you, I'm sure you're a master at other things. We've got to make you much less good at this. Keep in mind, if you're turning to or from food, whatever is going on, if you're doing something with food, it means you're turning away from something else. And when you can identify what that something else is, and it's different for everybody, and find a way to heal. Because often the other part of this is that when we have rejecting relationships or upsetting relationships or whatever with other people, we often internalize that voice, and then we are that to ourselves. That's the other complication. But I don't want to overwhelm you.
I'm not overwhelmed. I already knew it's incredibly complicated, I think.
It is, but complicated doesn't mean impossible. Yeah.
I'll try to keep that in mind.
Yes. So I would also pay attention to your dreams, and I'd pay attention to the way that you talk to yourself. How do you talk to yourself, first person, second person? And I would look at when you feel those fleeting moments of terror, what is happening? What is going on? And it may seem like nothing is happening, but if you keep being curious, not critical, curious, you're going to discover that there was some trigger. Often people think food is the trigger. No, there's a trigger and food is the solution. Just pay attention to what was happening, what was just said. I've talked before about people who say, I don't know if you've heard this part. I talk about this on the show all the time. The woman who suddenly heard Ben and Jerry's calling her name as she was watching TV. And she said, nothing was bothering me. Everything was fine. Well, watching the TV show massively triggered her. So when you feel that terror, when you think about food, when you hate your body, think about what's going on and whose voice are you using in relationship to your physical self. I know that's a lot, but those are things that you can start paying attention to. And
okay, I will. It just seems like regarding the last part of what you just said, the voice I'm listening to is a very reasonable voice because of how I do view my body, and it's a very valid voice, it seems like. So, yes, I will continue. I mean, I will try.
Just start.
To do as you suggested.
And call me back. Let me know what you discover, and I'll help you start, you know, teasing this apart and getting to the bottom of it, because obviously it is complicated. You have been in the relationship with yourself and your body for a long time in this way. So it's not going to be like my magic wand. I've been told my magic wand works. I have a magic wand in my office. I've been told it works just very slowly, but it works. So it took you a while to get to this point. It's not going to change overnight, alas, but you can start making, can start being curious about what's causing what.
Okay. Well, I immensely thank you for the time that you have taken and for your questions and for the suggestions that you have provided for me.
You're very welcome. And let me know how it goes, and we'll go to the next level of questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome, and thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh. Yeah, logic, being logical, is a protection, because logic is very black and white. It feels very safe, and it's black and white. Feelings and uncertainty and all kinds of other messy things in between black and white. I like to say they're color, because we can no longer talk about shades of gray, right? Not with that book. Color is in between black and white, but color can be messy and painful and difficult, and that can be difficult to tolerate. So we go to black and white, which is logic. Logic is safe. But we cannot change while we're in our safety zones. We cannot you can't change in your, what is that saying? It's all over Instagram. I probably even used it myself. Change does not come about in your comfort zone. It only comes about outside your comfort zone. Okay, so I was talking about how to get rid of guilt. Let me go through this. First of all, think about what your crime is, your quote-unquote crime. I feel guilty for eating pizza. I feel guilty for saying this. I shouldn't have said this. A lot of times, shoulds and should-nots are the quote-unquote crimes that we accuse ourselves of. And then look at, well, what does that behavior mean about you? So Jeanette was feeling guilty about eating not eating 100% clean. So what does that mean? Often it means something like, oh, I have no self-control. Oh, I have no willpower. I'm greedy. I'm too much. There's something wrong with me. I'm weak. If your guilt was not attached to food or weight, this is the important one, what would you be feeling guilty about? What would you be feeling guilty about? And that is, because often it is a lot easier for us to feel guilty about what we ate or didn't eat than it is to feel guilty about other things. So what guilt would you be feeling in your life if you were not feeling guilty about food or weight or body image or something like that? Something to do with you. What are your rules for yourself about wanting more? Because often we grow up with these rules like, don't be selfish, don't want that, don't want the bigger piece, don't want more money, don't want this, don't want that, be happy with what you have. Be happy with what you have because other people have it so much worse. This is what I hear a lot. You should just be grateful for what you have. Don't want more. Don't complain. Don't be a whiner. Who do you think you are? Don't be full of yourself. Don't be angry. Don't have feelings. Don't. So what do you do with what you want? What do you do with all those feelings of wanting? Maybe the one place where you can want more and have more is around food. So if you weren't thinking about food, what would you be thinking about? If you weren't feeling guilty for eating, What would you be feeling guilty about? Also, and this speaks to shame, what do you imagine is wrong with you? Your character, your basic essential self, and maybe it's something like, oh, I'm so needy, I need too much, I'm too much, or I'm not enough. There's something missing in me, I'm not lovable, I'm deficient in some indefinable way, or I'm deficient in these following five perfectly well-defined ways. What do you imagine is wrong with you, and where did you learn it? Where did you learn it? Childhood, family experiences in school, teachers, relationships with friends, romantic situations in the past. These are all, everything that you experienced taught you to relate to yourself and food in this particular way. And here's the good news. What you learned, whether you learned it 80 years ago or 8 months ago or 8 years ago, what you learned, you can unlearn. So what did you learn? What is another way of looking at the situation and your behavior with food? For example, maybe you say, well, I ate that whatever, not 100% clean item of food, but I am still learning to identify and process my feelings so I won't eat over them. I have conflicts about wanting more in life that makes me feel needy, but I'm not actually needy. I am a person with needs. Wanting more is not bad. Wanting more is not shameful. It is human. I'll be curious about where in my life I feel deprived so I don't turn to food to get more symbolically or to express conflict over wanting more out of life by eating. So as you can see, feeling guilty for what you're eating can sometimes distract from a stronger, deeper, more intense guilt or shame about having needs at all or wanting more of anything. But when you identify and process that core guilt and shame, you'll be less likely to attach your guilt and shame to your weight, to your body, to food, or anything else. That's how you make peace with food. The way that you relate to yourself changes the way you feel. And when you feel good and you can make yourself feel better with words and support yourself with words, you're no longer going to use food to distract yourself. How are we doing on time? Well, we have two more minutes. So for those of you who have been trying to get through, I know that some people were calling while I was on the phone. Call me. I will not be here next week, but I will be here in 2 weeks. Call me next week or write me and let me know your questions. I will be happy to answer them on the air and help you out. Remember, whatever you are dealing with, it is 100% true that other people listening are also dealing with it. Whatever is on your mind, someone out there can relate to. Probably a lot of people can relate to. So please let me know. Don't feel at all self-conscious about your question. Your question is valid, and be curious, not critical. If it's something you want to know about, it's worthy of getting an answer. And that is just about our show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on LA Talk Radio. I am here every Wednesday on the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio at 10 a.m. Pacific live. And you can listen later on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to podcasts. And if you like the show, please take a moment and give us a rating, because the more ratings I get and the more reviews, the more people can, the more the show shows up in searches and the more people that we, not just me, we, because if you're calling, if you're part of the show, you're part of the show. We, it's a community. It's not just me. It's us. We can reach people and we can help people. And that is a really great feeling. An effing great feeling. I can't believe I said that earlier. Okay. Thanks, everyone. I'll see you in a couple weeks. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.